Welcome to The Weekly Listen, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Brooke Verlaget Stolper. The Weekly Listen features our essays, read by Leighton Pugh.
World Order, A Crisis for Democracy. Philip Bobbitt. World order is on many people's minds these days, perhaps because it seems to be coming apart. For the first time since World War II, that is, since the founding of the institutions of the current world order, a European state has invaded another state and annexed its territory. Yet another state has admitted to deceiving its treaty partners by developing nuclear weapons and testing them in defiance of UN Security Council resolutions. A leading state has defected from the European Union, and there are secessionist movements in several other member states. The American president has renounced a crucial climate change treaty negotiated by his predecessor and accused some of the country's closest allies of exploiting their alliance relationships with the United States. I believe we cannot understand what is going wrong in the international order without first understanding what is going wrong in the constitutional order of states. Moreover, I believe that if we can successfully address the crisis of the state, we will be able to cope with the threatening dissolution of the world order of states. So let me begin with what seems to be going wrong with the dominant constitutional order, the parliamentary, industrial, nation-state. In 2018, the social scientist Kaas Mudde made the following prediction. 2017, he said, had been the year in which countless academics and journalists wrote to explain the unexpected populist wave that was washing over Europe. Next year, 2019, he said, the message would be, democracy is dying, but you can save it if you buy my book. Most of those commentators worried that the liberal democracies were about to repeat the experience of Weimar Germany, and there were troubling events in Turkey, Russia, Hungary, the Philippines, and Brazil consistent with this concern. Moreover, there is a disturbing trend generally toward greater admiration for having an authoritarian leader. In 2019, Freedom House, which charts these matters, reported the 13th consecutive year of decline in the global health of democracy. This decline occurred in all regions of the world, notably in the democracies that emerged after the Cold War. Above all, it occurred in Western democracies. Others pointed to the increasing disenchantment youth feel with social democratic models and their flirtation, at least when they're talking to pollsters, with authoritarian governments. In Germany, younger cohorts used to be reliably more pro-democratic than older ones. Now, both the young and the middle-aged express more authoritarian values than people did at similar life stages in the past. The picture is even less encouraging in the United Kingdom and the United States, where millennials surveyed today are markedly more favourable to having a strong leader instead of elections than their parents' generation was at the same life stage. The exception, by the way, is Sweden. For persons born at the beginning of the post-war baby boom, almost 60% regard it as essential that they live in a democracy. For millennials born in 1980, the figure is less than 30%. And it's not just that younger cohorts in the parliamentary nation states accord less importance to living in a democracy. A larger share of them also openly rejects democratic institutions. Of the more than 100 countries surveyed by the World Values Survey, the country in which skepticism of democracy is most widespread is Russia, where since 1995, an average of 26% of respondents have stated that having a democratic political system is a bad way to run the country. In the United States, 23% of millennials now express the same sentiment. Many anxious analysts also point to the smashing of liberal democratic norms by the current American administration, although I surmise this has more in common with the clumsiness of impetuous and ignorant adolescents running through a museum than with any purposeful iconoclasm. David Runciman, however, in his book How Democracy Ends, warned that by becoming mesmerized by historic examples of democratic self-destruction, we were missing the real challenges to the parliamentary industrial nation-states. Climate change and social media networks were undermining democracies in far more profound ways than illiberal populist movements. For example, take the problem of climate change. It is an existential indictment of the industrial nation-state that the yellow vest protesters in France felt bitterly betrayed by Macron's green taxes on petrol. He talks about the end of the world, they said, whereas we worry about the end of the month. A constitutional order that preempts concerns about future generations is not sustainable, and perhaps not worthy of being sustained. Perhaps even more threatening to the parliamentary nation-state is Facebook and the rise of social media networks. As Runciman concluded, Facebook's challenge to democracy is epistemological. The internet giants want to get to know us so that they can always give us more of what we want. The internet, despite all its promises about gathering the world's knowledge at our fingertips, actually closes our minds by tailoring that knowledge to reinforce our political biases. It is a short step from this world of post-truth politics in which no democracy can survive. By contrast, democracy depends upon keeping an open mind, being willing to change one's views in the face of new facts or new ideas. I believe that this is half right. The focus on the Weimar problem is exaggerated. The great parliamentary democracies are not going to have access to time machines. There will be no ultimate return to 20th century fascism or socialism, no matter what some followers of Jeremy Corbyn or Donald Trump may promise. The real problem facing the parliamentary industrial nation states is that they will fail by their very nature to cope with the novel problems their astounding 20th century successes have created. Moreover, industrial nation states of the kind we have known in the last century, whether they are parliamentary or not, are ill-adapted to manage transnational problems such as climate change and networked terrorism, or transformative information flows like those posed by social media. In fact, the attack on the legitimacy of the industrial nation-state is just as threatening to China and Russia as it is to the parliamentary democracies. Indeed, this is one reason for their increasing autocracy. This loss of confidence in the prevailing constitutional order of the state is what is driving the loss of confidence in democracy. This is not exactly a problem of democracy, and thinking of it as such is a very damaging error. Rather, it is a problem for the legitimacy of the state itself. Once we understand that, we will also be able to know what is required to repair democracy. 20 years ago, I wrote a lengthy essay describing the two-way relationship between strategy and the constitutional order of the state. I theorized that profound changes from one constitutional order to another invariably brought about equally fundamental changes in strategy, and that these changes reshaped the international order. Similarly, I argued, revolutions in strategy invariably brought about new constitutional orders that, as they exploited their more dynamic strategic postures, rewrote the rules for world order in their own image. In our time, we are experiencing another such turning point as the industrial nation-state decays and is challenged by the informational market state. The promise of nation-states was, give us power and we will improve your material well-being. But now the public's well-being has come to depend more on individuation and instantaneity, two demands that are at once more local than the one nation of the nation-state, and more global than the ponderous and insular decision-making of nation-state institutions, including the UN. Moreover, the satisfaction of these new demands comes at the cost of pulling back on the welfarist promises that legitimated the constitutional order of the industrial nation-state since its inception in the second half of the 19th century. Because these demands are undermining the prevailing constitutional order, they are also undermining democracies. And it is this that has led many persons to see what is happening as a crisis of democracy. Now the state itself is in play. Since the birth of the modern state, the state has been for a century or more a proscenium stage. The actors come and go, scripts change, the scrims are repainted, the stage is settled and appears permanent. Then, very subtly, the legitimacy of the prevailing constitutional order is discredited, often in war, sometimes in revolution, sometimes in civil war, which is a hybrid of both. Perhaps there is no more damaging error than the Westphalian fallacy, the assumption that the constitutional order of the modern state was set in 1648 and has not fundamentally changed since then. This is so destructive of thoughtful analysis because it blinds us to those rare but not unprecedented periods in which the constitutional order is replaced. Purveyors of the Westphalian fallacy say the state has not fundamentally changed in 400 years. If it now appears otherwise, then either the state must be disappearing or that apparent change is only illusory. But the modern state is not going away, nor has it remained fundamentally the same. Rather, as in the past, the state will survive by changing the basis for its legitimacy and thus creating a new constitutional order. If the crisis of the state is the problem and the threats to liberal democracy are only an epiphenomenon of this development, then we will want to shape the coming constitutional order, the informational market state, in ways that will preserve the values of liberal democracy. This, too, is not a novel problem. It was Abraham Lincoln's problem. Those who read the Gettysburg Address will note that it begins by drawing attention to this issue. By saying, 47 years ago, Lincoln referred not to ratification of the American Constitution, but rather the signing of the Declaration of Independence. His objective was to replace the imperial state-nation that had governed the United States since the adoption of the Constitution with a new constitutional order. His problem was to preserve the values of the Declaration in the new constitutional context. Now that is our problem, and it is also the real crisis for liberal democracy. This may strike you as an insurmountable one for market states. We're all familiar with the threats democracies pose to markets, markets on which market states depend. Protectionism, extortion, inflation, confiscatory taxation, the repudiation of debt, a hatred of inequality. And we also know the threats that markets pose to democracy, the corruption of officials through bribery, the power of wealthy groups to pervert the course of elections, an increased and oppressive inequality. We are less familiar with the need for markets to support democracy, although I can think of no liberal democracy that is not also a capitalist society. Markets also need liberal democracies, not just legitimating elections and representative governments that are the bane of anti-capitalist radicals everywhere, but the rule of law that protects property rights, respect for minorities that often are immigrant traders and financiers, and the adherence to regimes of human rights, including institutions like an independent judiciary and free press that protect and preserve the autonomy of the individual conscience. So it is not inconsistent to claim that market states actually need liberal democratic practices precisely because they depend upon markets to accomplish their political goals. it is a promising coincidence that truthful fact-finding and dispassionate discussion can also be helpful to successful competition in the market. And two, successful markets depend at least in part on the quality of state regulation of the market. Market states, therefore, have an incentive to preserve the channels of truth and debate. And those are the surest channels, after all, by which our political objectives can be successfully achieved. The problem is misdiagnosed as a problem of liberal democracy. It is rather a problem for liberal democracy that occurs when the state is weak, mistrusted, and discredited. The industrial nation state's legitimacy depended on satisfying its compact with the public. Give us power, and the state will improve the material well-being of the people. Apart from the longer-range challenges I have drawn attention to, it seems to me unmistakable that the public in all the liberal democracies no longer have confidence that the state can fulfill this bargain. The high watermark for optimism in the West is Sweden, the utopia of social democrats, where 44% of citizens believe that when today's children grow up, they will be better off financially than their parents. At the bottom of the pessimism barrel are the countries with long-term and perhaps even irreversible economic malaise: France, Japan, Greece, and Italy. America has long been the paragon of inveterate optimism, but today only 37% of Americans believe their kids will be better off, slightly less than in Venezuela. In Japan, 19%, the UK, 24%, the same as in Canada and Australia. In France, the figure is 9%. Nor is this pessimism without grounds. Data from the Equality of Opportunity Project draws this contrast. Instead of asking people how they feel about the future economic prospects of their children, the project charts what actually has happened to Americans based on when they were born. The data are striking. 90% of children born in America in 1940 went on to earn incomes that exceeded those of their parents, justifying that generation's faith in the American dream. For millennial Americans born in the 1980 to 1985 window, the figure is barely half. This loss of confidence in the state is what is driving the loss of confidence in democracy. What is missing in these figures, of course, and is also missing in the opinions of those polled, is any appreciation of how much healthier, safer, more spacious life is for each successive generation, regardless of whether income levels soar. Indeed, one of the chief contributions of globalization is the international arbitrage by which goods in wealthier countries are vastly less expensive than they have been, while wages in poorer countries advance dramatically. The skill will therefore lie not only in solving Lincoln's problem, preserving liberal values in a new constitutional context, but Roosevelt's also. How to attain success, the only ultimate legitimator for such a project. Success will begin with an appreciation, so oddly lost on so many political figures today, of what democracy requires of us, as well as what it promises. I want to close with a remark of Tomáš Masaryk when asked what was at stake in the struggle against the Nazis in Czechoslovakia. Democracy is not only a form of state. It is not just something that is embodied in a constitution. Democracy is a view of life. It requires a belief in human beings, in humanity. I have already said that democracy is a discussion, but the real discussion is possible only if people trust each other and if they try fairly to find the truth.
Thank you for listening to the Engelsberg Ideas Weekly Listen, read by Leighton Pugh. This podcast was brought to you by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation and produced by Buchverlaget Stolper. For more writing from the world's leading thinkers on history and culture, featuring essays, historical portraits, and regular podcasts, visit engelsbergideas.com.